We do have a pretty full agenda today, and so if you will please do your best to stay in the room so that we can have appropriate votes taken, that would be appreciated. Senator Cohen, would you be willing to chair right now? Thank you.
Senator Sieben, Senate File 2288.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Senate File 2288 is the online voter registration and absentee ballot application authorization. By way of history, which those of you in the room probably know, the Secretary of State implemented an online voter registration system this fall. Some of us in the legislature were pretty clear that we believe that the legislature should be pass a law enabling that to happen. And so the legislation that's before you today is will do just that. It will authorize for the online voter registration of voters. The general idea behind it, members, and why I'm supportive of it is because I believe that it's we need to keep pace with the times, in that we need to always balance that there is the security necessary and that it is a secure process, but that we are allowing people to register, to update their address, for example, or to register to vote in a manner that encourages them to do so. And I think that it's important to have enabling legislation so that we can outline and specify the terms that we believe are appropriate and should be in state statute, so that, for example, if there is another Secretary of State that does not believe in online voter registration and wanted to stop the practice, which could happen, that we have said that we support online voter registration. I do have two amendments to move that we could perhaps do, Senator Cohen. The A2 amendment.
Yes, you have. Yeah, Senator Sieben, you have this as a delete everything. So this is the first committee bill's been heard of, and heard in. So I assume you'd like to work from the delete everything amendment?
Correct.
Okay, so Senator Sieben moves that the A2 amendment, the delete everything amendment, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the testifiers will speak to the A2 amendment. It is the language that was agreed to by a variety of stakeholders who have been working on this. I also have, Mr. Chair, the A4 amendment. By quick way of explanation, it stipulates that people that registered under the current Secretary of State website can remain registered. So it's a notwithstanding the requirements of Section 201.061, which are what is outlined in the Delete Everything amendment.
Yeah. And understand that this, in effect, supplements the Delete Everything. Senator Sieben moves the A4 amendment. Is there further discussion on that amendment? If not, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, I believe that because we have a number of testifiers, perhaps we could, and because I did email out the Delete Everything amendment, the A2 amendment, to members beforehand, I can go through the Delete Everything amendment, but I think it may be best if we start to hear from some of the testifiers and then take questions at that time. So if we could please hear from Beth Frazier and Gary Poser, and then I know that after that, Alex Vagek, who's listed, would like to testify as soon as possible, because he has somewhere else he needs to be.
So, and who's first?
We'll We'll start with Ms. Frazier, please.
Ms. Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and Senator Sieben for carrying this bill. I'm Beth Frazier, the Deputy Secretary of State, and we're really happy with this legislation. As you all know, online voter registration is not a new concept. It was first launched in Arizona by then Secretary of State Jan Brewer, and then followed by Republican Secretary of State in Washington, Sam Reed, and is now in many states run by with Democratic and Republican secretaries of state. States are moving towards this technology because it brings incredible cost savings. In Arizona, they estimate that it takes approximately 83 cents to process a paper registration and 3 cents to process an online voter registration. As you know, it brings convenience to voters, allowing voters to register from the convenience of their own homes, their own PCs, and allows them to register without filling out information, private information, and handing it to somebody at a park festival or at a bus stop. Instead, they fill it out on a secure computer. It provides great benefits to counties as well, the local election officials, who no longer have to type in the information, have to decipher messy handwriting that can result in typos and potentially returned mail because of either transposed digits or messy handwriting. The tool that was launched last fall does require that people provide all of the same information that is required on the paper voter registration form. In fact, the requirements are more strict than the paper voter registration form because it only allows voters to proceed if they can provide a Minnesota driver's license or state ID card number or the last 4 digits of their Social Security number. It also requires that they provide an email address. The information is only transferred to the counties after that information has been verified with another government database to verify that the person actually exists in another government database. So it is impossible to use the system to register, for example, Mickey Mouse, because Mickey Mouse does not have a Minnesota driver's license number or the last 4 digits of a Social Security number. So that would be rejected before it even gets to the counties. It also requires people to provide their address in a way that makes it easier for counties to process because they have to select their address from a drop-down menu. So it does not require counties as registrations that come through the driver and vehicle services system does for them to say, okay, well, Highway 7 is also known as Broadway, so for it to meet up with our database, I need to change this address. So it provides great cost savings to counties. And when the information has been processed, the voter receives an email. If the information can be verified and it's queued for the counties for them to process, then the voter receives an email that says, you are now successfully registered. You'll be receiving a postcard in the mail with your polling place. If the data cannot be verified, either because of a typo, because they transposed some digits in their driver's license number, or because their name didn't match up, they receive an email that says, I'm sorry, we cannot verify your information. You may try again, or you can fill out a paper voter registration form. So it provides notice to the voters much more quickly than the current system. The bill also authorizes 2 other tools related to absentee voting, one for military and overseas voters, and allows them to apply for an absentee ballot online, as well as one for domestic voters, absentee voters. And similar to the voter registration tool, it requires the match of a driver's license or last 4 Social Security before the data is queued for the counties. So the real difference between the paper system that we've had for years and this system is simply how the data is transmitted. I'm happy to answer questions, but Mr. Poser also has information to provide to the committee.
Mr. Poser. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman and members, the Secretary of State's office, Gary Poser, and the Director of Elections for the Office of Secretary of State. The office has had a statewide system housing statewide voter registration data since 1988. We have, therefore, 26 years of securely maintaining registration data. The current statewide system is the third statewide voter registration system and was deployed in 2004 as part of the Help America Vote Act, and has been maintaining registration data containing driver's license numbers and last four social security numbers since that time. Online registration does not change our mission of securely storing voter registration data. We have had and will continue to have that mission regardless of how that data is gathered and input into the system. The Secretary of State's office and Minute have both used intrusion protection. We receive notifications of suspicious activity, and we block IP addresses that have been deemed as suspicious. All systems of our office use these protection measures, not just online voter registration. The office's voter information portal website, sometimes referred to as VIP, has previously been in place for voter registration status lookup and absentee ballot status lookup tools. VIP is also where the link to online registration is now accessed. The office has run the voter information portal web pages through security checking software prior to deployment. It is certainly visible on our public website URL that the voter information portal uses HTTPS versus the HTTP encryption protocols. Other state websites have been criticized for allowing the S to be removed from the HTTPS and allowed the user to proceed to the website using only HTTP, which was not secure or encrypted. The voter information portal, which has been previously in place for both voter registration status lookup and absentee status lookup, and that now contains the link to online registration, has always been structured to require the S and would flip back to HTTPS if it was attempted to remove and access the system without it. Access to SVRS, the statewide registration system, is itself limited by router use ACL, which basically means they must have a static IP address. The Secretary of State must specifically allow access through that IP address. The statewide registration system resides behind a firewall, and intrusion prevention is deployed. Users must have a statewide registration user ID, password, and role assigned, which limits users' access to certain functions of the system. We have approximately 20 state users, 240 county users, and 63 municipal users who have access to the statewide registration system data. We also conduct monthly audits that are run to seek unauthorized use of the system by users. And I'd be glad to answer any questions as well.
Questions for the Secretary of State's office? Okay, thank you. And then I understand Senator Sieben, I don't think I saw any questions, but I understand that you wanted, at least the list of witnesses I have, you wanted to have, is it Alex? Sure, I'm going to pronounce it Vigak. I'm not, I apologize.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Alex Vagic, and I'm a freshman at the University of Minnesota, and also a member of the University of Minnesota Twin Cities chapter of MPIRG, the Minnesota Public Interest Research Group. I'm here today to testify in support of Senate File 2288. Part of MPIRG's mission is to promote activism and civic engagement among students, and every year we do a large nonpartisan voter registration drive on seven college campuses across the state to encourage participation in our democracy. In 2012, we registered over 10,000 young Minnesotans to vote. Voter registration is a major part of our work, and we feel an online component should be a permanent option for Minnesotan voters. Online voter registration is a common sense tool for Minnesotans, and young Minnesotans in particular. We expect to be able to do many things online. We can pay tuition online, turn in assignments, and even file police reports. Putting voter registration online does not change the procedures of registration. It simply provides another, more accessible pathway to registering. Beyond aligning our voter registration system with the expectation of voters, there are other advantages. The tool ensures the information collected in a registration form is more secure when submitted online. Online submission reduces errors in data, which makes the system more reliable for voters and can save local governments money. The most important benefit to online voter registration, however, is increased access to voting. Among students, the most common excuse for failing to vote is lack of time. With registration form online, registering will be more efficient and accessible to those with limited time. What may be called convenience for some becomes a critical improvement in equity for others when we consider online registration's benefits for working class people, parents, and differently abled people. In the context of working long and often odd hours with limited ability to travel, online voter registration significantly improves access to voting. In 2012, Minnesotans voted down a restrictive amendment that would have made it harder for students, veterans, rural Minnesotans, and people of color to vote. In doing so, we made it clear that in Minnesota we are interested in expanding access to voting, and an online voter registration tool is the next logical step to this expansion. I encourage you to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Next person we have is Ms. Debbie Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Debbie Erickson, and I'm here representing the Minnesota Association of County Officers in support of Senate File 2288. We believe the online voter registration and absentee ballot applications provide counties with needed process improvements that help us provide better services without increasing costs and bring our systems more in line with the needs of the voters. From the county's perspective, we see significant advantages and improvements with the implementation of online voter registration. The nature of the process provides us with more accurate data, as registrations must be verified through governmental databases before the application can be forwarded to the county for processing. This reduces the amount of data entry time, errors, and incomplete and illegible applications. This also ensures that eligible voters are processed more quickly and efficiently, and by improving the timeliness of getting eligible voters pre-registered prior to Election Day, we will be able to reduce the amount of wait time in the polls for Election Day registration, improving the voting process for all voters. In addition, we strongly support the ability for eligible voters to apply online for absentee ballot applications. With the advent of no-excuse absentee voting this fall, counties are anticipating a significant increase in the number of voters who choose to vote by absentee ballot. Currently, voters must submit a signed application by mail, fax, or scanned email in order to request a ballot. If the application is incomplete or illegible, county staff must contact the voter or have the voter submit a new application before a ballot can be sent. With an online process that requires the voter to enter all necessary information, counties will be better able to complete the absentee ballot processing and serve the voter in a more efficient and effective way without incurring additional costs. Additionally, historic trends have shown that the busiest absentee voting period are the last several days of the process. With the ability to submit applications online, voters who suddenly find themselves unable to be at their polls on Election Day will have a better opportunity to request their ballot in a timely manner. Online voter registration process improvements and efficiencies will help to mitigate the expected increased cost and work with regard to no-excuse absentee voting by ensuring application data is complete, reducing the amount of additional work needed to provide a ballot to all voters, including UACAVA voters. These military and overseas voters who use the federal postcard application form as required also benefit from online access. Because their application for absentee ballot also serves as an application for voter registration purposes, the ability to apply for an absentee ballot online but not to register to vote could have the unintended consequence of disenfranchising some of our military voters. The implementation of online registration responds to the demands of the voters by providing necessary modern tools to meet their needs, and we urge you to consider support of Senate File 2288. I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Questions from the committee? Okay, thank you. Next we have Dr. Halperin. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Max Halperin, professor of computer science at Gustavus, with a particular interest in election technology. I'll be addressing security issues with this bill, and most of what I say would apply equally well to the next bill that the committee will be taking up, so I'll note that. I'll try to be brief. I'll also try to be clear. If I err on the side of brevity rather than clarity, I'd welcome follow-up questions. Security is never complete. It's all about risk and the mitigation of risk. A secure system is one where accepting the remaining risk is preferable to the alternatives. Moreover, risk depends not only on the likelihood of harm, but also on its severity. So for security risks, we conventionally consider three factors: the likelihood an adversary will mount an attack, the likelihood an attempted attack would succeed, and the damage that a successful attack would cause. Security results not just from hardening targets, but also from making them less inviting and from limiting the damage. This perspective means an online registration system is automatically more secure in Minnesota than it would be in most other states because we have election day registration as a fallback. Two big categories of attack are rendered essentially pointless: those that would knock out the registration system as a deadline nears, and those that would fraudulently change voters' addresses so as to remove them from their actual precincts' rosters. There remains one other goal an attacker might have for fraudulent registrations, which is to obtain ballots with which to vote multiple times. This kind of impersonation is harder than fraudulent change of address, with a greater risk of prosecution, because the perpetrator must emerge from the anonymity of cyberspace in order to cast the ballot. Here, too, Minnesota is in better shape than some other states, because we don't allow absentee ballots to be downloaded from the web. To cast a ballot, one has to show up in person or provide an address to which the ballot is sent. Nonetheless, some hardening against fraud is important. The registration system must demand authenticating information that is not readily available. Again, Minnesota starts out with a leg up. Some states still assign driver's license numbers based on name and birthday. Either a Minnesota-style driver's license number or the last four digits of a Social Security number is generally considered an appropriate authenticator. Thus, both bills measure up. Finally, in addition to fraud, we must consider the possibility of outright penetration. As a metaphor, rather than someone stealing your ATM card and withdrawing cash as though they were you, they could take a crowbar and pry the whole ATM apart. To some degree, this is a risk whenever a computer system has a public-facing interface and then another connection to the behind-the-scenes data storage. In particular, the statewide voter registration system already was connected to other public-facing systems, as Mr. Poser described, so the risk is not new. Section 201.022 of the Minnesota statutes already requires this data be secured, and both of the bills before the committee would reinforce that requirement. For these reasons, I'm convinced that an online registration system can be appropriately secure in Minnesota, and that each of these bills contains adequate safeguards against fraud and penetration when taken in concert with existing law. Welcome any questions about the bill that's before the committee.
Okay, and Dr. Halpern, this might not be a question for yourself, but looking at the, while you were testifying, the security sections, there's language about evidence of suspicious activity that cannot be resolved by the Secretary of State. So I assume that's made, there are no guidelines for that. That's made just internally within the Secretary of State's office. Maybe that's better directed toward Ms. Fraser, but and then it talks about an appropriate law enforcement agency. Do we assume that's the county attorney, or is there some other law enforcement agency that would? Now, how is the Secretary of State going to determine the appropriate law enforcement agency?
Mr. Chair, the appropriate law enforcement agency would be related to the county from which the application is related. So when you fill out the application, you have to indicate which county you reside in. And so we would refer it to that county attorney.
So we assume it's the county attorney, not another law enforcement agency. It wouldn't be a city attorney. it wouldn't be the Attorney General's office. It would simply, we don't have that many offices, agencies that handle law enforcement, unless you're sending it to an investigatory agency, say something like a county sheriff or a city attorney or a police department.
Mr. Chair, generally we refer items to the county attorneys and they forward them on from there for investigation.
The county attorney would then send it to, if appropriate, for investigation to the sheriff or some other law enforcement agency. So does it make more sense just simply to say to the appropriate county attorney as opposed to law enforcement agency? It may be a distinction without a difference.
But, Mr. Chair, I'm looking to counsel to see if there's a discrepancy, if there's a difference between appropriate law enforcement agency and, as you suggested, the appropriate county attorney. Or does law enforcement agency encompass county attorney?
Ms. Daniel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Sieben. Of the two terms, the appropriate law enforcement agency is more of a broad umbrella, and that would indeed cover the county attorney's office. If you look on page 5 of the A2 amendment, later on in the bill, we talk about referring investigation and this is a jurisdiction section, and it talks about investigating and prosecuting in the county in which the individual registered or attempted to register. So at a different point in the bill, we do talk about the specific county when we get to the jurisdiction. So I think either way would work.
Mr. Chair, I think it's fine. And to your, I believe you had a second question, which was, what is suspicious activity?
No, not that so much, but just that the evidence of suspicious activity is a little bit broad, but obviously that's a determination by the Secretary of State as to what constitutes suspicious activity. I don't think that overreaches, but obviously there's a lot of subjectivity relative to that.
Well, Mr. Chair, and you'll notice that in other sections of the bill, there are things that specifically address, try to get at security questions. So, for instance, the Secretary of State's office will maintain the individual IP address of each registrant. So I would imagine that suspicious activity could encompass if that IP address, if it's not coming from, I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself now here, so perhaps I'll have Ms. Frazier help me with this, but if the IP address is not coming from, I don't know enough about IP addresses to be speaking to this, actually. Ms. Frazier, can you help?
Ms. Frazier. Mr. Chair, if, for example, there were many applications coming from the same IP address, we might say, what's going on? And, you know, might realize, oh, this is a public library. There's a reason that there are many applications coming from one IP address, for example. Or if there were many problematic registrations coming from one IP address, we could shut that IP address down or refer that information to the county attorney so that they could go, you know, investigate whether there was some sort of issue there.
Okay, thanks. So I guess my question wasn't so much a question for Dr. Halperin. It just kind of brought that to my attention. So any questions for Dr. Halperin? Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, Mr. Halperin, I do. And by the way, I saw that suspicious activity thing, too, as a vague-ish kind of word, and I appreciate the explanation, but I would agree, Senator, that it raises a flag to me, too. But, Mr. Halperin, the question I have for you is, you testified in support of both bills, essentially, but when I took a look at 2345, it's a little more specific about security, and also a report on security and some other things is in there. I'm just wondering if, even in light of some of the security measures they said, I guess I take it from trust but verify, especially on something new, if some of that language from 2345 might strengthen and be helpful even to 2288, the A2 amendment.
Dr. Halperin.
Mr. Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer, I certainly agree that we can trust the Secretary of State's office to be employing best practices, but I also would agree with you that codifying that those best practices are to be followed would be a perfectly reasonable choice for this legislature to make.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Sir Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Professor Halperin, just as a follow-up question to Senator Kiffmeyer, we have in front of us a bill that you are comfortable with that, in accordance with Minnesota statutes, proper security procedures can be put in place. But would you not agree that it would be a good idea to test the system and review the system to determine that the system as actually implemented complies with Minnesota law so that we know, in fact, it's secure?
Dr. Halperin.
Mr. Chair and Senator Newman, no testing can ever guarantee that a system complies with security standards. Security is inherently an area where unknown unknowns as well as known unknowns crop up, where defenders are trying to make sure that there's no, you know, sewer pipe the attacker can think to crawl through, or, you know, those kinds of things to bring us back a few centuries. The attacker only has to think of one clever means of attack that the defender hasn't, and the system can be breached. So testing is always incomplete, always partial. But that said, it is one of those standard best practices that I alluded to do some measure of testing and auditing and have outside parties try to do some penetration testing. And I understood Mr. Poser to say that the Secretary of State's office does engage in that kind of thing. And as I indicated to Senator Kiffmeyer, I would consider it very reasonable of the legislature to make that explicit in the language.
Mr. Chairman. And in terms of your area of expertise, is standard best practices, you know, a term of art that folks involved in the computer world would know what you're talking about and be able to proceed with those practices to make sure that the system is secure?
Dr. Halperin.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Newman, I don't think there would be 100% agreement on exactly what is encompassed within that phrase. But I do think that people of ordinary professional qualification would have a good understanding, and that it would be an understanding that is necessarily evolving, that there are certain things which as the threat picture and technological context changes, what steps a security professional would take would evolve as well. So a very detailed, rigid list of exactly what's to be checked and what constitutes a suspicious behavior and so forth would be a mistake, would freeze us in, you know, 2014. But the kind of language, for example, that's in your bill, which, you know, does not go into exhaustive depth but does provide some indication that outside testing is to be done and so forth, that seems like an appropriate level of specificity if that was the wish of the legislature.
Thank you, Professor. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Fraser.
Mr. Chair and Senator Newman and Kiffmeyer, and perhaps Mr. Halperin can comment on this as well. One of the as you know, and as Mr. Poser testified, we did have the system tested before it was launched. We worked both with Minute and we contracted with Veracode, which is a very esteemed security company, and they fully tested the system before it was launched. One of the issues with the proposed report in your bill, Senator Newman, is that it asks for detailed explanations to be given to the legislature, presumably in what is then a public report, about all of the security protocols and all of the security in place for the system. And one of the things that our computer people have been telling us, and I understand was even more stringent under Secretary Kiffmeyer when she was in office, was that one of the best means of security is not to give too detailed a picture of what the security is, because otherwise it shows where the holes are. And we have, so therefore, I don't think that we could provide some of the detailed explanations that you're looking for in this report. We are allowed to, under state law, and are happy to continue to provide detailed security information to the legislative auditor, and have worked closely with Minute. But I do think that there are questions about providing lots of detail to the public about here is exactly what we're doing to protect the system. And maybe Mr. Halperin can comment on that.
If I may.
Sure, Doctor.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'll just clarify that when I said the sort of language that was in Senator Newman's bill, I was thinking of the security portion that says maintain confidentiality, use encryption, ongoing testing, monitoring, consult with the Minute Chief Information Officer, those items. I was not speaking about the report section. I would concur with Ms. Fraser that a report would need to be cautious about what information it made public, that providing a detailed roadmap of your systems is probably not one of those best practices.
Okay. Further questions for Dr. Halperin? Senator Kiffmeyer, did you have a question?
No.
Okay. Sure. All right. Thank you very much.
Sure.
I'm sorry, Senator Limmer. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's reference in the amendment that makes reference to a four-digit, the last four digits of your Social Security number. And I can't help but wonder, would that last four digits ever be available to the public?
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, not that I am aware of, it would not be available to the public, but that's also one of the current acceptable numbers that a new registrant can provide on the paper application, so it's consistent.
Mr. Chair, what was kind of interesting, a few months ago, I was talking to someone on a telephone regarding an account I wanted to open, and for a security code, they wanted my first five digits of my Social Security number. And since my last four digits are elsewhere in this world laying around, it wouldn't take much of a harvester to connect the dots real easy. Has that been contemplated by this proposal?
Dr. Halperin?
Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, I think it's perhaps worth noting, given the question you just posed, that the first five and the last four are quite different. That traditional Social Security numbers, until just recently, the first five were assigned based on your state, and the last four not. And so traditionally, and certainly for anyone who is currently of voting age and for anyone who will be of voting age for some years to come, the first five are fairly readily guessable, whereas the last four, no more guessable than any other four digits would be. The concern is whether they've become used for enough different purposes that they might become known. And for any one individual, it's certainly possible that your Social Security number could become known. But the kind of the risk calculation here is that when coupled with all the other precautions that are in place, it would be sufficiently difficult and sufficiently expensive for someone to obtain enough of those Social Security numbers to be able to swing an election. And that's a risk calculation a number of states have made. Last week, the committee heard from the NCSL representative that their information on their site that Dr. Halderman provided had also suggested that the last four of the Social Security number was an appropriate authenticator.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm not wishing to extrapolate about whether or not they could swing an election. I'm thinking about someone who could merge some numbers together and have a large number of completed Social Security numbers that could be used for a much more devious and expanded purpose rather than this narrow discussion we're having right now.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, I'd point out that those four digits that you provide are still private data. It's not becoming public data.
Yeah. Right.
Further questions for Dr. Halperin? Thank you very much. Next witness is Ms. Sherry Knuth. If you could identify yourself, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and the committee. I'm Susan Tucker, the Executive Director of the League of Women Voters, Minnesota. And with me is Sherry Knuth, Policy and Outreach Manager. This year, the League of Women Voters, Minnesota will be marking our 95th anniversary of ensuring that every citizen's right to vote is protected. Today, we have local League of Women Voter units in 34 communities across Minnesota, with membership in greater Minnesota, inner-city neighborhoods, and the suburbs. Our members host and moderate hundreds of nonpartisan forums and debates across the state, register voters, and answer questions from voters about elections. Our state office also runs a hotline before major elections, taking calls from voters who have a wide variety of questions about elections. These experiences help to inform the proposals that we support at the legislature. We often hear from election administrators, as well as our fellow League of Women Voter members across the country, that Minnesota is well respected for how we run elections. However, there are areas in which Minnesota needs to modernize its election system, and one area is ensuring that the online voter registration is available.
Mr. Chair, I am Sherry Knuth from League of Women Voters. Online registration was recommended in two very recent national reports, a bipartisan report by the Presidential Commission on Election Administration, and a nonpartisan report by the Pew Charitable Trusts. It has proven successful in other parts of the country in saving taxpayer dollars, protecting the integrity of the system, and improving voters' experiences. Online voter registration systems eliminate costly steps involved with paper-based systems, among them transcribing handwritten forms. Indeed, just 2 months ago, League of Women Voters Minnesota received a request from a county auditor asking us to utilize online voter registration forms whenever possible when registering citizens to vote, because it would ease the auditor's burden in entering data from handwritten forms. And because you'll be hearing another bill immediately after this, I'm going to address a couple comments to that bill as well. The League urges you to approve SF-2288 and reject the provisions of SF-2345. The present system of online voter registration has proven effective and secure. Regardless of how it was implemented in our state, the registrations of those who have registered online should be honored. To invalidate those registrations undermines confidence in government and leaves taxpayers asking if their tax dollars are being used wisely. We also urge the committee to approve use of online voter registration with the last four digits of the applicant's Social Security number. This allows use of the online system by those who need it the most, such as those who are homebound due to disabilities or old age and do not have driver's license or state ID cards. Finally, we support providing for electronic applications for absentee voting. Electronic applications save taxpayer dollars and improve voters' experiences. We urge you to reject SF-2345 and adopt SF-2288. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for either witness? Okay. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Knuth, you make a statement that that this was a system that has proven secure. How do you know that it's been proven secure?
I don't know from firsthand knowledge of working with the system, but I have not heard of any reports that there has been any problem with the registrations.
Thank you, Ms. Knuth. Mr. Chairman, I can appreciate that, but like Mr. Halperin said, it is a system So I think proven secure is just my question. The other one I wanted to ask Ms. Knuth is how would your request to do some online voter registration, how would you do that? What is the process by which you or are doing so?
Mr. Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer, actually, since we received that request from the county auditor in Olmsted County, we've been struggling with that, wondering how we might be able to use online voter registration in the community. I think we would be more able to use it when we are at a community college or a setting of that nature where we're not having a big number of voters come to the table at one time. But we have not figured out a way where we would be able to use it at naturalization ceremonies. Right now, the league registers thousands of voters at naturalization ceremonies. And we do so by having a PowerPoint in front of the auditorium and a league volunteer who leads the applicants in filling out paper registrations, which are actually, they're filled out in advance of the ceremony, but are not signed by the person until they become a citizen. They sign it after the citizen ceremony is over. So we have not determined if it might be feasible to use online registration in the immigration ceremonies.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sieben.
Just to follow up, Mr. Chair.
If I may, Senator Kiffmeyer, I'd just draw your attention to line 1.32 and 1.33. It says specifically in the legislation before us that an individual may not electronically submit a voter registration application on behalf of someone else. So that is specifically not going to be allowed. Now, whether if the actual individual is doing the inputting and filling out the form online themselves, then I assume that would be acceptable, but it specifically says in the legislation that someone else cannot do it for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that clarifies things for right now. Thank you.
Okay. Further questions for the witnesses? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Next person is Mr. Justin Page.
Mr. Page.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Justin Page, and I'm a staff attorney at the Minnesota Disability Law Center, a statewide project of Minnesota Legal Aid. Minnesota Legal Aid is a federally protected protection and advocacy system for individuals with disabilities in the state of Minnesota, and we represent people with disabilities throughout the state. Our office receives funding through the Help America Vote Act to protect and advocate for voting rights for people with disabilities in a nonpartisan fashion. I'm here today to testify how Senate File 2288 will help individuals with disabilities exercise their right to vote. Historically, people with disabilities have faced significant barriers when registration and voting. Unfortunately, these barriers have led individuals with disabilities to vote at a much lower rate than the general population. We believe that this bill will make it easier for individuals with disabilities to vote and will encourage people with disabilities to more fully engage in the political process. There are currently at least 19 states that have adopted online voter registration. We urge Minnesota to follow the lead of these other states and the recommendation of the Protection Presidential Commission on Election Administration, which stated earlier this year that more states should adopt online voter registration and codify online voter registration into law. The commission in its report that the ease of registering online increases voter registration and removes barriers to participation by voters with disabilities. Online voter registration also saves money. We believe that it is good policy to implement election reforms such as online voter registration, which would reduce costs, increase efficiency, and allow individuals with disabilities to more fully engage in the voting process. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to testify about how Senate File 2288 will help individuals with disabilities exercise the right to vote. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Thank you. And then we have Mr. Tucker Sade. Apologize if I mispronounced that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Tucker Sade, a student at Gustavus Adolphus College in St. Peter, Minnesota. And based on my experiences, I feel that Senate File 2288 would help the election process in two ways. It would decrease the amount of election day registrants, which would help out the election judges in Minnesota, and it would also help by letting a computer check for trivial errors made on applications. During the fall of 2012, I took a course on election administration topics. Part of that course was to be involved in the November presidential election. Our professor gave us a few options to get involved, but the one that stood out to me was applying to be an election judge. I thought it would be a great opportunity to enrich my understanding of how our election system works and to offer service to my community. While I chose to be an election judge, another group of students decided to hold a registration drive in our college dining room. They thought that since St. Peter is full of first-time voters, this registration drive would minimize the amount of election day registrants. After the registration drive, the group discussed some hardships they encountered over the course of the event. When the students were filling out the registration sheets, they often missed a section or filled it out incorrectly. In some cases, they had to redo the whole sheet again because their mess-ups couldn't be corrected. However, they managed to get through it, and they registered 232 students. A couple weeks later, election day came, and the morning at the St. Peter precinct where I worked was pretty quiet. However, by midday, we had a line of voters out the door who were all waiting to register. Clearly, the line was caused by the amount of election day registrations, which amounted to 767, which is almost half of the 1,539 voters we had that day. Looking back at the registration drive my fellow students ran, the 232 registered voters seems a little insignificant compared to the 767 same-day registrants. I believe that adding an online registration process would vastly decrease the amount of election day registrants, especially since most new registrants are young and have grown up in the age of the internet. Instead of printing the registration sheet out, filling it out, finding an envelope, addressing the envelope, praying you can find a stamp somewhere, putting the stamp on and taking a trip to the mailbox, I would much rather sit down in front of my computer and fill out an online application. Also, in reference to the group that held the registration drive, I believe that using an online registration process would help catch mistakes made by registrants, and having a computer check for trivial errors on applications before they submitted would save time, and time is important in any election setting. Thank you for your time.
Thanks. Questions from the committee? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
That concludes the list of witnesses that I have apparently that I'd signed up earlier. I don't know, Senator Sieben, if there are other people who wish to testify on the bill. Apparently not. So we have the bill in front of us, Senate File 2288, for discussion and amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have an amendment, the A5 amendment.
If we could have that distributed.
And it was good to have heard all this discussion in regards to the amendment, but I just took the length. Oh, sorry. The author needs a copy.
Yeah, if we could just have it distributed to committee members for a second. Okay, I think, Senator Kiffmeyer.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. What I'm doing here, members and Senator Sieben, is I'm taking some language from Senator Newman's bill that strengthen the secure issues that I feel are still there. And that is the first page, line 1 down to 136. The second one, section 11, line 2.4 on the back of the amendment, has to do with the report, but I would do an oral amendment to the language on line 2.5 and strike after report on line 2.5, the chairs, and on 2.6, ranking minority members of the committees in the House of Representatives and 2.7 up to the word that, and insert instead the legislative auditor.
If there's no objection, we'll have that language incorporated into Senator Kiffmeyer's amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sieben.
Could either Senator Kiffmeyer or counsel then read what it would say?
Yes. Counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The amendment, again, I'll repeat that and then I'll read how I'll read afterwards. On line 2.5, delete chairs and delete line 2.6. And on 2.7, delete everything before that and insert legislative auditor. So as amended, that would read, by December 15th, 2014, the Secretary of State must submit a report to the legislative auditor that addresses the following issues.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sieben.
A question for the author. Senator Kiffmeyer, how do you anticipate then this information would be used by the legislative auditor? Or what's the rationale for having the information go to the legislative auditor?
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Sieben. I think it addresses the issue of security of the information, that instead of it going to a legislative body, it goes to the legislative auditor who works on behalf of the legislature, who can then review this information. And there is a legislative committee made up of legislators that the legislative auditor could consult with or minute, depending upon if he saw something in this report that might need follow-up. And that would be a legislative auditor does a variety of these things already. So I think that the legislative auditor could handle it. But it just gives us a layer of a buffer between the information and the openness of the information going to legislators, and instead it goes to the legislative auditor. So I think it addresses that concern and yet allows the information to be communicated.
The report would go to the legislative auditor. That's the order. We have the A5 amendment in front of us. Is there further discussion on the amendment? Senator Sieben.
Mr. Chair, could if Senator Kiffmeyer would please explain the front of the amendment to what the goal is here of this language and how it would incorporate into the bill before us.
On page one?
Correct.
Okay. If you take the A2 amendment that goes with the 2288 and let's see. Here it is. 2288. So page 2, line 3, we would just insert the language here that is given.
Mr.
Maybe,
Chair.
Maybe our general counsel can walk it through better than.
And I think there might be another change.
I'm not quite sure if I'm addressing your question or if there's something else.
Let's maybe we could have counsel address just the language question so we know what we're working from. Is that okay, Senator Sieben? Or?
Right. And, Mr. Chair, I understand that where it will get in court, I can put it together where it's going to go in the bill. I was just asking for an explanation from Senator Kiffmeyer of why she believes this legislation is necessary, why the proposed changes are necessary.
Okay. So before we do that, let's have counsel's got another change that needs to be made.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is to go along with the proposed amendment from Senator Kiffmeyer that was on lines 2.5 through 2.7. On line 2.27, we would also need to change legislature to state auditor. So delete legislature and insert state auditor. Or legislative auditor, I'm sorry.
Senator Kiffmeyer, did you? Mm-hmm. Would you incorporate that into your amendment then?
Yes. Okay. Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, then. So, again, we've got the A5 amendment in front of us. Senator Sieben, you had posed a question.
Mr. Chair, I'm trying to work on the fly here to see if we could, if this language may be acceptable to the Secretary of State's office, so perhaps we could hear from them on some of their initial comments on it, too. I'm sorry, after Senator Kiffmeyer talks about her explanation.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I better understand your question, Senator Steben. It was more as to why, not the actual legislative language. I think for me the concern is there's been a lot of presumption that it's secure, and this is newly put together. There have been concerns about this. We've had other issues in the state of Minnesota about things that were supposedly secure, and then things happen. And so, as I mentioned before, trusting and yet verifying. And so what this does, it just enumerates a little more specifically so that it is without question instead of a presumption that it is just secure because you say so. And so for me, this is just iterating more specifically. It looks like more than it actually is because there are several places where the same language needed to be done. So the actual body of the language, the B, C, and D, are just repeated in a couple of other places. So the real meat of it is in those first three B, C, D paragraphs.
Is that what she asked? Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we could hear a response from the Secretary of State's office when they have time.
Mr. Chair and Member Senator Kiffmeyer, I guess the one question I have about the language is it requires an annual audit of the system. And I just don't know how much that would cost for a minute to do or what sort of cost that would impose. I mean, everything else here is already built into the system when we are doing ongoing testing and monitoring. And so we don't have a problem with that. I just don't know what the cost of the annual audit
Mr.
would
Chair.
Be or exactly what an audit is.
Sarah Steven.
Mr. Chair, I would move to divide the amendment after between section after on page 2 between lines 2.3 and 2.4. I believe that if the audit becomes or we can get more questions about how much it costs, hoping that it won't be too much, and then I would hope that I would support the language on the first page and the beginning of page 2. I'm a little bit concerned still, members, that the report to the legislature, I, as the chair of the committee, who I will be chairing it again in December, I am very happy to take testimony from the Secretary of State's office, to have them come in and talk about how the process is going and all of these issues that are addressed here. I do have a little bit of concern about us mandating that the legislative auditor do this report, just because I'm not real familiar of us telling the legislative auditor to, or for the secretary to tell the legislative auditor to do a report. Senator Kiffmeyer, I'm happy to work with you on this report language and see if there's something we can work on at a later time and maybe amend on the floor and a subsequent committee. One other point is that anytime we require a report, there is a cost involved, and just not being sure of what those costs would be too, I'm a little bit reluctant to go before Senator Cohen's committee at this time, not knowing the full cost of the report.
Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Speaking as a member of the Legislative Audit Commission, I share Senator Steben's concern, Senator Kiffmeyer, and the Legislative Audit Commission is very jealous of its role in directing the work of the legislative auditor. And although the legislative auditor responds to individual members' requests for investigations, et cetera, although he also in his office can also undertake them on their own authority, I think that we're very reluctant to add to the duties of the legislative auditor, particularly without giving them additional appropriations to carry out additional duties. So I hope we will be cautious about doing that, not only in this bill, but in other bills as well. The Legislative Audit Commission appreciates all of the respect that legislators want to give the independence, and we value that tremendously, of the legislative auditor as a nonpartisan office representing the legislature as a whole. But please do not put directives to the legislative auditor that have not gone through the Oversight Committee of the Legislative Audit Commission. Thank you very much.
Well, we have Senator Sieben's request to divide the amendment. By the way, Senator Sieben, your division would take place after line 2.2, not 2.3. But if there's no objection to the division, and Senator Kiffmeyer, you're the maker of the amendment, so why don't we deal with that first section of the amendment? So that would be on page 1 through line 2.2 on page 2. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the things that concerns me is that the previous testimony implied, I thought, that the system was regularly audited. So I was not thinking that this was adding a big additional burden. So which is it? Is it
well,
or not?
And I think I'm sorry. You accepted the division. So you accepted the division.
I am on the first part, Mr.
Okay.
Chair, I believe.
All right.
The report was the second
report.
Part.
Okay, I'm sorry. I thought your comment was relative to the report.
No.
I'm sorry. I misunderstood you. I apologize. Go ahead.
I'm almost thank you, Mr. Chair. Right. All right. So we're on the first part of the divided amendment on specifically line point 1.12.
Mr. Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer, the system is tested and monitored. I guess I'm not entirely sure exactly what an annual audit encompasses. Maybe that's a technical term that the IT people will understand. I just am not entirely sure what that means.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would be glad to, if we can bring this amendment and place it on the language, I'm certainly glad to refine the annual audit or give you more clarification on that. I think that is something that is can be mutually agreed to. I can't think of anything more at this time. It could be biannual or could be something else if that's satisfactory. But I do think in some way on a regular basis, and I thought that was already being done.
Well, Mr. Chair, in the interest of time, I hope that the committee would support the language as Senator Kiffmeyer proposed, and that the committee will support an affirmative, will vote yes on adopting this section of the amendment of the proposed language.
So we have Senator Kiffmeyer's motion on first section of the amendment, again, page 1 through line 2.2 on page 2. Is there further discussion on that motion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries. Then we have the second part of Senator Kiffmeyer's amendment, starting on line 2.3 on page 2. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sensitive to Senator Rest rightfully saying so by addressing one concern. I created a new concern. But my concern still is left with the fact that I think it would be very helpful to the legislature to have this report, and considering Senator Sieben has said that she would work with me on finding some language that might address all of those concerns, I would be glad to leave this particular section temporarily and then go forward and place it at a future time on the Bill 2388 after we get some language worked out, if that's okay with Senator Sieben.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, I'm happy to continue to work with you to try to find some language. I just want to be clear that I don't want you to have the understanding that there's other concerns that were raised by the testifiers and concerning the cost, but I'm happy to try to work through those issues.
Well, if I understand, Senator Kiffmeyer, you're withdrawing the balance of the amendment then, is that correct? Did I understand that correctly, or...?
Yes, Mr. Chair, if that's the appropriate action to do at this time is to withdraw this part of the amendment in lieu of bringing some language further in the next step.
Fine.
Thank you.
So Senator Kiffmeyer withdraws the balance of the amendment. So Is there further discussion or amendment to Senate File 2288? If not, Senator Sieben moves that Senate File 2288 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Rules. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Sieben. You can resume the chair, Senator Sieben. All right, well, next we have Senate File 2345, Senator Newman.
Senator Newman, Senate File 2345 is before us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to give a brief explanation as to my purpose in bringing this particular bill forward, and then I'm going to ask Senate Counsel, who has graciously prepared a memo, which is sort of like a side-by-side comparing the differences between Senator Sieben's bill and my bill, and I think that will kind of speed things up and will help the various members. First of all, I want to say, so that there is no misunderstanding about online voter registration, that I do support the concept of online voter registration. I think it's high time the state of Minnesota adopted it, and I'm going to do whatever I can to see that an appropriate bill is passed that addresses this issue. Having said that, I do have a couple of concerns. Partly was addressed in the divided amendment that we just adopted in Senator Sieben's bill. But there are a couple of other things that I do want to address. And the first thing that I want to address is that of the responsibility of the legislature. And when I speak to you of this, I'm talking specifically about separation of powers. I'm not talking to you as a Republican senator. I don't expect you to listen to what I have to say as a DFL senator. I'm talking to you about being legislators. And I'm asking you to look at this issue as Minnesota state senators. I was greatly distressed when the Secretary of State's office last year unilaterally adopted an online voter registration system in the state of Minnesota without coming to the legislature. I believe that the Secretary of State directly stepped into our wheelhouse, and that is our constitutional mandate to enact and enable legislation. And it is for that reason and in support of that notion that I have included in your packet a number of items which confirms, at least in my mind, that there are others besides myself in the state of Minnesota that were really concerned with the adoption of an online voter registration system in the state of Minnesota without an act of the legislature. So the first thing that comes to mind in terms of my bill is the fact that what I am attempting to do is to preserve the existing system that the Secretary of State brought forward without, in effect, repealing it. The current bill, or the bill that we're going to have, I have to offer my amendment. But once we get to my amendment, it's a significant change from my initial bill, where I was saying in my initial bill that we should simply scrap the old system. And so with the amendment that I'm going to be offering in here in a moment, I'm not doing that. And that is a significant step back on my part. And I'm doing it because in an effort to find some kind of compromise language. But the whole purpose, the beginning position for me is that of separation of powers. And I think it's important because at some time in the future, I have no doubt that there will be a court case involving the executive branch effectively instituting legislation instead of the legislature. And I have a very real fear, having watched the judicial branch for a long, long time now, that unless the legislature steps in on this issue, that the judicial branch will in the future latch on to what has occurred in terms of online voter registration, determine that we have set a precedent in allowing the executive branch to effectively enact legislation and simply adopt that. And in doing so, when we allow the executive branch or the judicial branch to create new legislation, it really dismantles what our whole purpose here is all about, and that is representing our constituents. And so what I'm trying to do is maintain the integrity of the legislative branch of our government. And that is the first thing. That's the separation of powers issue. We spend a fair amount of time talking about the report to the legislature, and we can talk about that some more. And then the last thing is the appropriation. In my bill, there is an appropriation for the legislature to pony up the money necessary to adopt an online voter registration system. And I'm doing that for two specific reasons. Number one, I think an online voter registration system should belong to us. We are the legislature. And if we are going to adopt such a system, then I think we ought to pay for it. It also, an appropriation also goes into and supports the line of the separation of powers. If we appropriate money for it, it is ours. It is not the Secretary of State's office. And the final reason for my request for appropriations is I have no idea how much the current online voter registration system costs, and I don't think anybody else does. And I think we have a right to know, because we are the legislature and we are the ones that are appropriating money and creating the system, not the executive branch of the government. So with that explanation, Madam Chair, in order to get my bill in the form that I would like to have it, I would offer the A2 amendment.
Senator Newman moves the A2 amendment. It's an author's amendment, and this is the first stop of the for the legislation. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The A2 is adopted.
Madam Chair, with that explanation, perhaps Senate Counsel could walk through the memo that she has graciously prepared for us. And I had her, Mrs. Stengel, prepare a previous side-by-side, and now she has gone through and done a side-by-side, knowing that we had two delete all amendments coming, and I just thought that would be a fairly quick way for us to compare the two bills.
Thank you, Ms. Stengel.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Newman. The memo in your packet is dated March 10th, 2014, and the subject line is Comparison of Electronic Voter Registration Bills. So that's what I'm looking at here. And it, as Senator Newman says, covers the author's amendment that we adopted to Senator Sieben's bill and the author's amendment we just adopted for Senator Newman. So it's comparing the amendments, not the underlying bills. So first it talks about all of the things that both bills do, and that's allow people to register to vote 20 days before the election, and that's how it currently is for election registration prior to Election Day. Both obviously require the Secretary of State to maintain the website. Both require the same information to be included on the paper and electronic registration application, require the applicant to provide an email address. They're both effective immediately, and there is verification in both of them that the information matches from the application to a government database before the application is accepted. As we have discussed at length earlier, there are different security provisions And we've seen the security provisions from Senator Newman's bill that were adopted in Senator Kiffmeyer's amendment to Senator Sieben's bill. So I'll skip over that section. Senator Sieben's bill does a few different things, but since we're on Senator Newman's bill, I think I'll just skip to the last section and talk about the things that are unique to Senate File 2345, which is before us now. One of the major differences is that Senate File 2345 suspends the current online voter registration until June 1st, 2015. And in the meantime, until that point, the Secretary of State must submit his report to the legislature, and then there's a legislative session to address any issues that come up during that time. And until that June 1st date, no system should be available online. Under the Newman bill, the applicant is required to provide the last four of a social and a driver's license or state ID number, date of birth, which is required in both bills. But you'll also see that there's a requirement for an electronic signature, and there's two pieces to the electronic signature. The first piece is that the applicant must have a signature on file with the Department of Vehicle Services, and that's like when you go in and get your driver's license and you sign, they keep an electronic copy of that. And second, there is the electronic signature on the application itself. And this bill specifically specifically requires the electronic signatures on the online application pursuant to the Uniform Electronic Transactions Act. That's what it is. And there's a specific cross-reference that brings that in. I already touched on all of the signature information. This bill specifies how when applications must be rejected. So if information is missing or doesn't match or those sorts of things, it's rejected. Notice must be sent via email to people whose application is rejected and to those whose applications have been accepted. And another big difference here is while this system is suspended, the Secretary of State must go back and create a list of all of the people that registered on the system that's operating today and determine if they were newly registered or if they were using that system to update a registration. For the people that registered for the first time through the system, their registration is temporarily suspended until they submit a new voter registration application meeting all of the requirements. And as Senator Newman points out, there is an appropriation, and again, there is the required report that we've already talked about.
Thank you, Council. Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that the significant differences between my bill and the Sieben bill is, again, simply we're not simply accepting as valid the online voter registration system created by the Secretary of State. Rather, we are, as a legislature, being involved. And we, as a legislature, created it, and we own it. The idea of having the system created by the Secretary of State's office being suspended, what that does is it accepts the online updating of voter registrants, whatever or however many that may have been. But those who were new registrants, they are not accepted. And that is an effort on my part, again, to address the fact that this is the legislature's online voter registration and not the executive branch's online voter registration. The report is the second part about the bill that is different than Senator Sieben's. And, you know, we've already discussed that quite a bit during Senator Sieben's presentation. I think members have got a pretty good idea what the difference there is. And then the final piece is the appropriation. And for the reasons that I indicated earlier, I believe that if this is a voting registration system that we as a legislature have created, then I think we ought to pay for it. And I think we ought to know how much it costs. And consequently, I have put in a line regarding an appropriation. Obviously, I don't know what that's going to be until We have the ability to ask for a fiscal note. But those are the three major differences between the two bills.
Senator Newman, did you have, we have listed Dr. Halperin as testifying on your bill since he spoke to it earlier. Would you still like him to comment on your bill? Or?
No, I think that's unnecessary. I had asked Professor Halperin to come and testify today, and I appreciate very much the fact that he did. I think his testimony was very helpful on the issue of security and answered, frankly, a lot of questions that I had. So unless members have a specific question of Dr. Halperin at this time, I do not.
Is there anyone else in the audience who cares to testify on the bill before us? Senator Newman?
Then with that, Madam Chair, I believe that the appropriate next place for this bill to go would be to the Finance Committee, given the fact that I'm asking for an appropriation. I would move that the bill be recommended to pass and that it move to the Finance Committee.
Senator Newman, on your motion, I'd just like to state before, as amended.
As amended,
I'm sorry.
Full committee.
I'm sorry. Senator Newman, the correct motion is that your bill would be referred to the full Rules Committee first.
Oh, I'm sorry. I would amend my motion in accordance with that.
So on that motion, Senator Newman, I very much appreciate your willingness to talk about my bill that we just passed. I would say that at this time I'm opposed to your bill because of the costs associated, as you mentioned, and I certainly understand and respect your rationale for doing that. I also do have some concern that we're requiring different standards for online voter registration versus paper registration. If I understood what Ms. Stengel said in your bill, you would require in Senate File 2345 as amended a driver's license or state ID, the last four digits of your social security number, date of birth, and an e-signature, which is a different standard for the bill that we just heard, which matches the current standards for registering on paper. So for those reasons, I hope that you'll continue to weigh in on the bill that the committee just passed, but I am going to oppose your bill as amended. Seeing no further discussion, Senator Newman renews his motion that Senate File 2345 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Rules Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
The motion does not prevail, and the bill is not agreed to.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Thank you, Senator Newman. The next, before we move on to Senator Hoffman's, before I forget, I'd like to move the minutes from the March 5th meeting. Senator Cohen moves the minutes from Wednesday, March 5th. Is there any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion is passed. Senator Hoffman, Senate File 2402, Campaign Finance Technical Changes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and some members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to present Senate File 2402, the Campaign Finance Technical Bill. I want to recommend, Madam Chair, that Senate File 2402 pass as amended and be referred to Rules and Administration. That should be the next place it goes from here. Madam Chair, the changes proposed in this bill are primarily administrative and technical and do not represent significant policy changes, but rather clarify policy. These changes are important for the efficient and fair administration of Chapter 10A by the board. Broadly speaking, the bill has five goals. Number one is to update existing law so that the language conforms to changes made in Chapter 10A in 2013. Some will said 1913. That's pretty bad. These changes are important so that the wording used in Chapter 10A is consistent and clear. Number two, securely timely disclosure of amendments to campaign finance reports The bill provides an increase in the daily late fee penalty available to the board if a committee fails to amend a report in a timely manner. The bill also provides the board for the first time with the ability to require a committee to respond to a reconciliation question. Clarify reporting requirements and timelines. The bill clarifies the deadline for judges and county commissioners filing an economic interest statement and clarifies the filing schedule of campaign finance reports by constitutional candidates. Provide a base for the board to start the development of a web-based campaign finance reporting application. And then finally, it clarifies board proceedings and the rights of parties. Madam Chair, at the table with me today is Mr. Jeff Sigurdsson, who is the Assistant Executive Director of Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. And Madam Chair, although before Jeff starts, I would like to bring the A3 amendment. This is my author's amendment that puts the bill in the shape that I want. And members, you should have the A3 amendment. Ms. Stengel, if you'd like to comment on the six lines of this amendment, that would be helpful.
Ms. Stengel.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Lines 1.2 and 1.3 of the amendment just clean up some language. There are a group of retired judges that may be reappointed, and they refer to themselves as senior judges, but that's not something used in the statute, so we just cleaned up that language to that. And lines 1.4 to 1.6 clarify what the intent of who will not be required to make the reporting. So if you did not file for office, you don't have to submit the reports.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, my question regards to you as to this is under the, isn't it the Statement of Economic Interest that Section 9 refers to? That they would be exempted from filing that, or maybe General Counsel can answer that.
Madam Chair, Ms. Stengel.
Yeah, it's on the notes from the General Senator Hoffman. It's on Section 9, I think it is. Right.
Oh,
that's where it said that it applied to the Statement of Economic Interest.
Madam Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, yes, those senior judges don't need to submit that report.
My question is, why would they not? If there are going to be many times the retired judges, they're appointed to serve and to be conducting business, why would they not have to comply with this provision of a statement of economic? They're still judging like any other judge would be.
A great question. Madam Chair?
Ms. Haas.
Actually, there's Ms. Haas here, or Mr. Sigurdsson can answer that question.
Ms. Haas, welcome to the committee. Please state your name.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Nancy Haas with Messerly and Kramer, here on behalf of the Minnesota District Judges Association. This was a bill last year that added, it was a Senator Marty bill that added county commissioners and district judges to the economic disclosure. It was specifically designed to deal with conflicts of interest, but since judges are governed under conflict of interest by court rule and the Board on Judicial Standards, they removed that piece from it and only really did the economic interest statement. Although we think that that was duplicative, we did not oppose the language last year. One of the things we learned during the summer and trying to work on implementation with the Campaign Finance Board is the issue around when those notices are sent and who they are sent to for retired judges specifically. Retired judges do not have an office. Their only address is their home address. And so whereas for other elected officials and judges, both on the economic interest form and when you file for office, there is a safety and security issue that you can provide a different address other than your home, for instance, your business address. And we found that that just was not the case for senior judges, and so there was a concern related to that. In addition, there was an issue around how would they get the notice. You know, could we? It would need to go through maybe the court administrator or the state court administrator. So after all of that work, it was our desire, and the board agreed that this was something that we would not have retired judges respond to. So that's why it's in the bill here today.
On the A3 amendment, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? the A3 is adopted.
Madam Chair, thank you. And now Jeff Sigurdsson is here to walk us through the bill as it stands.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Sigurdsson. Please state your name.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Jeff Sigurdsson. I'm the Assistant Director of the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. And thank you to Senator
Hoffman. Could you
Hoffman.
Just please speak up a little bit?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Sir.
And
the microphone.
And thank you to Senator Hoffman for carrying this legislation for the board. I will, with the committee's permission, just go through a quick walkthrough with the bill. Most, again, is technical changes. There are a couple of sections where I'll slow down and do a bit of an explanation because while we don't believe it's a policy issue, nonetheless, it may not be clear from the language of the bill what exactly is going on. Section 1, throughout the statute in Chapter 10A, we prefer to use greater than an amount. For example, the disclosure that you provide for contributors or expenditures on your campaign finance report is for an amount over $200, and that's typical in 10A. However, there are a few places where the language is more than was $2,500 or more in this example. And there are a couple other exceptions like that where we're just trying to get the language consistent in 10A where it's always going to be more than a certain amount. Section 2, in 2013, the registration requirement for a candidates committee was raised from $100 to $750. However, there is also a definition of candidate that also referred the $100 amount. And again, just to make the language consistent between 2013 and current language, we want to raise the point at which an individual is considered to be a candidate from $100 to $750. Section 3 is again going to incorporate language that was actually adopted in 2013 into other places in Chapter 10A where it was missed. This is where we're changing from a probable cause standard. When I say we, the board changes from a probable cause standard to issue findings or find that a violation existed. That's a very low standard. Basically just means it's more probable that it occurred than not. And go to a higher standard, which is a finding of facts, conclusions, and orders. Again, this is actually done in 2013, but there are a few places in 10A where that was missed, and this is one of those places. Section 4 on page 4, deleting the language concerning probable cause. Section 5 is one of the sections where I need to slow down and explain what's going on. This is the data privacy issue to electronic reporting system. If, as you may know, candidate committees and almost all political committees and party units are required to file electronically with the board. The way that's done is that the board is currently providing free software, campaign finance reporter software, which your treasurers are probably using. That software has a couple of problems. One, it's on the treasurer's personal computer. That brings in the whole issue of trying to support multiple versions of Windows, which is very difficult to do. As you go from Windows 95 to 2000 and to XP to 7 to 8, the software has difficulties. And frankly, for a small agency, it's difficult for us to keep the software current with the various versions of Windows. Secondly, if you use a Mac computer, you also have a problem because you would have to have emulation software on your PC, which again needs to be updated, so that you can use your Mac to file the reports. And then third, it's very difficult for us to push out changes. In other words, if there's a statutory change like we saw in 2013, we really need to rely on the treasurer or the candidates committee to go to our website, get the most recent upload or a version, I should say, of the software, and use that version. If they don't, they're using a version of the software that doesn't have the most recent statutory requirements. So to try to resolve all of those issues, the board wants to be in the position of going to a web-based filing system, where, in other words, you'd go to your website, you'd go to our website, you'd have a username and password that would be secure, and you would then enter in the various transactions that you usually would into the campaign finance reporter software directly onto this web-based application. The problem is that much of that data the board has no right to. Again, remember that there is a disclosure level. If it's not over $200, then the contributor doesn't need to be itemized, the expenditure doesn't need to be itemized, things like miscellaneous income does not have to be itemized. So to deal with that, what this is providing is that when a treasurer goes on to this, as of yet, non-existent web-based reporting system, the data that they enter into that system will not be government data, even though it's residing on a server maintained by the board or a storage solution maintained by the board. it will not become government data until they file the report. And then that information, which does meet a disclosure requirement or that is aggregated together in terms of unitemized contributions, that information is put into a report that's sent to us electronically. And at that point, it becomes government data, just like it is with your PC-based system. But this will allow, again, treasurers to enter in information, a $25 contribution, for example, that would not be itemized, and it will not become government data until such time as the report is filed. Section 6, Section 6 is dealing with the, is the first of the examples where we need to have a little bit more response from committees who do not respond to the need for an amendment. Sometimes we find that information is provided on a report that is incomplete, either there's not an employer, not address information, or other information that's obviously missing. That's not necessarily a violation. We notify those committees that there's missing information, and as long as they amend in a timely fashion, there's no violation. Unfortunately, some committees don't amend in a timely manner, and we have found that the $5 per day late filing fee simply isn't sufficient. We use $25 a day in all other parts of the program, either for filing the report late in the first place and also in the lobbyist disclosure reporting. It's $25 today. And we do want to use that consistent penalty here in this area, in this for amendments as well. Section 7, again, stepping back for just a moment, you probably recall that there was a reconciliation issue with contributions that were made by a registered committee with the board that were made to another registered committee. And sometimes those numbers didn't reconcile, as was pointed out by the Star Tribune. There are a lot of reasons why that occurred, and the board is trying to address all of those reasons. But one of the reasons was that committees were not required under the current provisions of Chapter 10A to even respond to the board if there was a reconciliation question. One of the committees, for example, that would say that we gave a $500 contribution to this other registered committee, and that committee says we received no such contribution. Well, one of those committees is correct, so we can't say that it's an amendment situation because one of those committees is, in fact, correct. But if they don't respond to us, don't explain what happened there, then we aren't able to reconcile the records, and we are then holding those records back from public disclosure until we find a solution. So this will give us some leverage to, again, make sure that committees respond when there's a reconciliation question and get that sort of disclosure to the public as quickly as possible. Section 8 is dealing with the economic interest statements. As you recall, in 2013, district court judges, appellate court judges, and county commissioners outside of the metropolitan area were brought in for the first time for the economic interest statements. It wasn't clear when they filed. This provides clarification that it's 60 days after assuming office. Section 9 is, again, already been mentioned and reviewed by Ms. Haas, so I won't go over that again. Section 10 is another of the more than examples, again, confirming language. Section 11, this is, again, one that was missed in 2013. Again, the disclosure level went to over $200. This is one example where it was left at $100. And so to make it consistent with the rest of the changes in 2013, the disclosure of dues and membership fees will occur when it goes over $200. Section 12, this is dealing with some reporting issues that we had. Basically, it was that it was requiring, the current language was requiring constitutional candidates to file every general election year, even if they weren't on the ballot. And, of course, on a four-year term, you're only on every other general election ballot. So this clarifies that they only file the extended schedule of reports, six reports, one on those years in which they're on the ballot. And also, again, as counsel clarified, provides that if you didn't file for office, you don't need to file the report at all. Section 13 is looking at the level at which disclosure needs to occur for the 24-hour reporting period. If you look on the top of page 9, it was that a principal campaign committee would have to, within 24 hours, disclose a contribution that's over 50% of the election cycle contribution limit. That was a mistake. It should be segment. The effect, for example, on a Senate campaign is that you would be disclosing contributions over $500. If it went with election cycle, it would be over $1,000. So it was intended to be segment. Section 14 is simply moving the publication of the expenditure limit from the state register, where we don't think it's really paid much attention to our website. Section 15, again, this is dealing with the probable cause standard, moving it to the straight findings of fact standard. Section 16 is the conforming language that's in statute 13.607, which is again dealing with the gives us a special exemption from the whole idea of government data. This is going again mirroring what we saw earlier for the website, having web-based reporting. Section 17 is a 211A, which is not actually a provision that's administered by the board, but Representative Simon asked that we include this because he believed it was non-controversial and this would be a method to bring it forward. This is for local level candidates only. Local level candidates are not required to form a separate bank account or register a committee, but they are required to report the ending cash balance that they have for their campaign. So in most cases, local candidates are in fact using a personal checking account, and it was difficult for them to determine what that number would be. This clarifies that they're only reporting the ending cash balance of those monies that are designated for a political purpose. Also in 211A, the term receipts and expenditures are not defined, but the terms contributions and disbursements are. So to take advantage of those defined terms, we're now incorporating those into 211A. And then the repealer in Section 18 is, you see on the last page of the bill, is basically dealing with a tool that the board has never used and would be very reluctant to use. It provides that if a public official, other than a member of the legislature or a constitutional officer, fails to file the economic interest statement, that the board has the authority to suspend that individual from their duties without pay. Again, the board has never used that, but considering the ramifications of that, it just wasn't a tool that the board would ever want to use as well and would prefer to have out of the statute. And with that, if there are any questions.
Senator Rest.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Sigurdson, I have had a couple of communications with Mr. Goldsmith about updating campaign finance reporter. I haven't looked in the last few days, but prior to that, the 2014 campaign finance reporter is unable to take information from 2013 with regard to limits, not only in from special interest groups or however we talk about whatever we say PACs and lobbyists are, but in making sure that additional contributions from people who are not lobbyists in 2014 does not impact for senators the moving someone up into a large donor category. And I think that some campaign treasurers, maybe not people who are as paranoid about the correct reporting as I am, but some campaign treasurers are not going to notice that, and they will, and all of a sudden someone who has raised a $6,000 now has raised $7,000 because individual contributors who are not lobbyists or PACs have exceeded $500 in the two-year reporting cycle. Is that fixed now? And if not, when will it be?
Mr. Sigurdson.
Madam Chair, Senator Rest. The answer is no, it's not released as of yet. We are doing the testing. Basically, the fix is, as you say, to link the 2013 and 2014 databases together, which we can do. But when we look at, there's really three tests that we need to see. One is campaign expenditures, because that's on a two-year
segment. I'm sorry?
Campaign expenditures is on a two-year segment. Special source limitations, as you mentioned, and then just the individual limits also are on that two-year segment. All of those are also under testing, and I think that's going to be released within a matter of days. I would also point out that one of the benefits of the changes in 2013 was that the period in time in which a committee can return a contribution that causes a violation was extended to 90 days. So any contribution that was received in 2014 at this point can still be returned. And when we do release that version, obviously we're going to be doing a lot of outreach to all treasurers, all committees, candidate committees in particular, but really all committees, explaining that they need to upgrade immediately, to run a compliance report to see if there are any violations, and three, outline if they do find a problem, the steps necessary to return that contribution.
Madam Chair,
Senator Rest.
I appreciate that, but again, we have, you know, some campaign treasurers that are not going to be on top of that right away, and I don't think it's going to, you know, we want the combination of 2013 and 2014 with a, obviously with the campaign expenditures, but it's probably, it's unlikely that any member of the Senate or a prospective candidate that wants to run in 2016 is going to violate that particular one. It's the other two that are going to, I think, cause an issue. And I hope that when that is done and you do reach out to people, that you don't start slapping fines on them, because that's just not fair. And they should be able to have an automatic reckoning through the system that they're required to file by, rather than having to keep going back and seeing whether somebody gave you money last year and how much and whether they're over and if you have to return it. And it's not a matter of 90 days. It's about having a system that is responsive to the changes that we made in 2013, which is now 9 months ago.
Yes.
Mr. Sigerson.
Madam Chair, Senator Est, I agree. I will say that not recently, but two or three or 4 years ago, there was an issue with the software where, in fact, the 24-hour notice was not doing what it was supposed to. And there was another situation where, in fact, some types of lobbyist contributions, I believe in-kind contributions, were not being counted for a special source as well. In both of those cases, the board recognized that treasurers have been, or rather that the board promotes the software as providing adequate compliance checks, and if there was, in fact, a violation that the software didn't identify, the board's solution was that the prohibited contribution still had to be returned, but that there was no violation. Obviously, I'm not in a position to speak for the board, but that would certainly be staff's recommendation. If we are in a situation where the software fails the treasurer, that we would be certainly very aware that the board should consider that when applying any penalty.
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator
Rest, I'm pleased that, at least in this setting, that you are publicly stating that that would be a recommendation of the to the campaign finance board not to find unwitting treasurers that are just trying to do their jobs.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question about Section 8 on page 5, and this has to do with a statement of economic interest. I've noticed this for a while, the varying amounts of time. So line 5.31 at 60 days, if it's an employment, 60 days assuming office, 14 days after you file an affidavit of candidacy, 14 advice and consent and so on, and then 60 days if you're in the racing commission. Why wouldn't they all be the same 60 days?
Mr. Sigerson.
Chairman Seaman, Senator Kiffmeyer, I can only provide a little insight into that. Some of the, for example, the racing commission, frankly, I have no idea. But the reason for the issue with on Section 3, where you have the 14 days after filing an affidavit of candidacy, I understand, at least, or my understanding is that there was always an interest in getting that information in time for the voters to consider that information prior to the election. With some of the appointed officials, that isn't so much of an issue. I mean, they will be before, of course, in most cases, and or I should say in some cases, they will be before this body for confirmation, but in that case, we have, again, the different time period to get that information for you. But and that's the Section 4, if it has the consent of Senate, that we need 14 days, so that's in a timely manner, so you can consider that when you review that person's appointment to a position. The 60 days is within, assuming the office, that has worked basically well for the board dealing with Soil and Water District. You may recall that those individuals also now file that document. There's a lot of people who file for that office who are never elected. I think that that's probably, at least with county commissioner, a case there. Rather than accumulating that data, the idea here is to accumulate the data, provide it to the public so that they can review it in terms of any conflict of interest. But that's why there's a 60-day issue there.
Madam Chair, just to follow up with that. It seems to me that on line 6.4 in the new 4 section, that if they're requiring the advice and consent of the Senate, the 14 days should be for undertaking the duties of office, not after, because the following that understanding, since the Senate is voting, they should have the interest statement of economic interest before voting on consent of the Senate. In regards to 14 days after filing an affidavit of candidacy, such as Senator Rest said, you have new candidates in particular who this 14 days, very difficult. Many times they get the packet when they file for office thinking they've done things, and I think the 14 days is too short. I would like to ask you to maybe consider, as this bill moves through, amending those two in some respect. But in particular, to give a candidate, I think having the information prior to the election, true, but I don't think 14 days necessarily serves as much of a purpose as you might think. And I think it is a very important piece of information, but I think that properly giving them some time, more time than 14 days. But I will give that those comments, Madam Chair, and for them to just give it some thought and consideration. I am not at this point feeling that I'm informed enough to necessarily make an amendment, but I think it is something that we just should consider as we move forward.
Thank you. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I could bring the committee's attention to page 9, section 15 is what I have. I have a few questions regarding. On line 31, page 9, it talks about the board must make a public finding in the matter. And I was wondering, how does the board establish a public finding? Are there rules to that?
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, yes. In 1002, the description of the board's authority to take an investigation either under its own authority or in response to a complaint, conduct an investigation, and then based on the results of the investigation, they issue findings, at which point the results of the investigation become public.
And then, Madam Chair, is there a timeline or a deadline upon investigation beginning of when that would end? Or can one have an open file on that for years?
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Chairman Seaman, Senator Limmer, I believe the statute provides within 30 days unless an action by the board is taken to extend the period of time for the investigation to occur. As a practical matter, I will tell you that very simple investigations can be concluded in 30 days. By simple, I mean, frankly, the candidate admits that a violation occurs and is willing to just resolve the issue. When there's a more of a question as to the actual facts of the matter, 30 days simply isn't sufficient. The board is very aware, and staff is extremely aware, that this is not a situation that investigations are very stressful, and that it's best to conclude them as possible, as soon as possible.
And Madam Chair, if one had a recalcitrant candidate or campaign that didn't want to cooperate, the process of making a public finding, does the board have subpoena powers or can they write court orders? I see that we're taking all of the civil court action out of the bill, and I was just wondering how much teeth are left with the board to exact accurate information.
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Madam Chair, Senator Lindner, yes, the board does retain the authority to issue a subpoena. I would also say that part of the provision that you see on in line 3.3, talking about referring to the District Court of Ramsey County, that there were two problems here. One is that the language currently is must bring an action. Well, in most cases, again, the candidate or the committee, I should say, that the finding is against will accept the findings and simply pay the fine. So why would we bring an action in Ramsey County? And then secondly, it is redundant. If you have a moment, I can find the statute. Ah, thank you. It's in 10A.34. Subdivision 1A says the board may bring an action in the district court in Ramsey County to recover a fee, late fee, or penalty imposed by this chapter. In other words, we already have that, but in this particular provision, the term is may bring, and the one that we're deleting, it's must bring.
And Madam Chair, if I could bring Senator our Limmer. Attention over to page 10 in the same section 15, I see that starting on line one, all money recovered under this section must be deposited in the general fund of the state treasury. Is that covered in another area where monies that might be recovered? Is it listed somewhere else in statute where that money would be deposited?
Mr. Sigurdson.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer. Yes, sir. It's certainly not the board's intention to have those funds come to the board. We always have believed that would create a very bad public perception as to why a fine was being imposed at a certain level. And I'm not sure Mr. Goldsmith has the other statute where that's referenced at. Okay, thank you. And 10A, .02, subdivision 15, deposition of fees. The board must deposit all fees and civil penalties under this chapter into the general fund.
Thank you.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Sigurdson, on page 7, section 11, looks like you want to go from $100 to $200 a year before the names of members have to be disclosed. My question is, are we dealing with political funds in addition to ballot question political funds and independent expenditure funds? I mean, are all of those included in this disclosure provision?
Mr. Sigurdson.
Madam Chair, Senator Newman. No, sir, this is very specific to these types of political funds. For example, a ballot question fund disclosure is only at over $500. This, again, was an example where everyone else is at over $200. The type of communities that you're talking about when there's a direct contribution, this is bringing it into line with that. Now, there is, you did mention independent expenditure committees and funds, I believe. Remember, they have a different sort of disclosure mechanism. They have underlying disclosure, which have different levels. That's over $5,000, typically, when you have disclosure of underlying source contributions in that case. This is, again, just bringing the $100 itemization of individual funds being given to a political fund up to the same level as other types of political committees and funds.
Madam Chair, Mr. Sigurdson, that does cause me some concern, because when you go from $100 to $200, if we're dealing with an organization with thousands of members, we are easily getting into an area where there's significant amount of money being deposited without the disclosure of the membership, and that really does cause me a great deal of concern. I am, in point of fact, wouldn't have any problem if we were dealing with contributions to all of these different funds. But to just go from $100 to $200, if you're dealing with an organization with many, many members, it is a significant change, in my estimation, in your bill. It isn't really just a technical change.
Mr. Sigurdson.
Madam Chair, Senator Newman, I probably didn't clarify this very well. That change from going from itemization of contributions of over $100 to $200 was put in place for party units, candidate committees, political committees, and political funds in 2013. In other words, the current standard is over $200. This was just one place in 10A where that standard of was not raised by oversight. So while you may have a point with the policy issue of the increased threshold at which any individual is going to be itemized on a report, this is just one section that was missed. But naturally, that decision was, for all other types of committees, was made in 2013.
And Madam Chair, Mr. Sigurdson, what other, you said that this was a section that was missed. Could you give me the site of the other sections that deal with the change of $100 to $200?
Mr. Sigurdson.
Madam Chair, Senator Newman, it'd be in 10A20. 10A20 is where the itemization threshold for contributions and expenditures are listed for again, candidate committees, party units, regular political committees, and there you'll see that they've all been raised from $100 to over $200.
Thank you, Mr. Sigurdsson. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Sigurdsson, for walking us through the bill as it stands. Madam Chair, I would like to now offer the A1 amendment and ask that as it's being passed out, Ms. Stengel, if you could walk us through each section that it's going to help out, and then I will have some additional information as to what we're looking to change.
Council, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Hoffman, looking at the A1 amendment, the first section is Section 3. It starts on line 1.3, and this just specifies that the executive director is not an ex officio member of the board. That's not a change. It's just stating how things currently are. The next section is Section 4, starts on line 1.14 of the amendment, and the changes start at the top of page 2. And basically, this requires advance notice to be placed on an agenda and supporting documentation to be given to the board before a meeting. And if that's not done, that issue can't be brought up and discussed at that meeting. Section 5, starting on 2.9, requires the board to adopt rules that set forth a procedure for audits and investigations, and it must specifically address these 5 concerns here, and that will make sure that there's a uniform process for audits and investigations. Section 6 starts on 2.29, and this has a few different changes here. One of the things that we are doing, the amendment is doing, refers to a prima facie determination to see if there is, the complaint alleges a violation. And for those of you that might be wondering, prima facie just means basically at first sight, is there a sufficient level to establish that something has happened? Notice must be given. They must allow an individual to be heard. The board must allow an individual to be heard before they make that prima facie violation. If they do find that the complaint alleges a prima facie violation, then the board must conduct an investigation. And this the same section continues on page 4, where you see some conforming changes referencing the prima facie violation. And then on 4.22, it specifies that things maintain their confidentiality as it is under law now, except for that initial determination. And then the final determination, Section 7 on 5.5 makes a conforming change, and Section 21 on 5.16 goes with the earlier rulemaking authority, and this gives the board the authority to use the expedited rulemaking process and states that the rules must be issued by the end of September. And I should note, this is not a delete everything amendment. This is tucking new sections in the existing bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. Madam Chair, I have to add, and Ms. Stengel, thank you for walking that through. The changes are important. An amendment in Subdivision 5, we clarify the executive director. It's clarification that it is the executive director is not an ex officio member of the board. And the reasons are the members of the board are appointed by the governor and confirmed by a 3/5 majority of both houses, the only public position in Minnesota with such an approval process. And you remember the intent of the legislation was that members on the board have strong, broad-based support in order to serve. And it also clarifies that the only members of the board may act and participate in board functions in the official capacity. So, again, there was some information last year. Senator on the floor was trying to make sure they clarified the role of the board and specifically as it pertains to making the executive decisions or the decisions that are governance to the board. So I'll keep going. Amendment in Subdivision 8, that it really is about a reasonable amount of time that you must give information to. And anecdotally, there's been a one-day notice. And you know, Madam Chair, in my role as an advising and assisting person, both on the federal and the state level, you know what? One day is not ample notice to give you the ability to make some informed decisions, especially when you're a governance board like this board should be. In this day and age of electronic notice, listservs, and emails, that has to be literally a day's notice or even less is not okay. The board needs to provide adequate public notice about matters that come before it. And then the provision makes it easier for the media and members. This is the full disclosure. This is also about being transparent. If there's one thing I brought here after 8 years on the Anoka-Hennepin School Board is you got to be transparent to the people that put you here, and this is one provision that says that. There's a stem valve where the board can override the 7-day notice requirement, but that's only by a unanimous vote. It puts the board as the, again, in the governance role. Going on to Subdivision 10, the expedited rulemaking process that we put in place is that, you know, the board does have subpoena power and can initiate its own civil lawsuits and may refer people to the county attorney for civil or criminal prosecution. Yet, the board has no written procedures for how it conducts investigations, not even a simple investigative protocol. This, again, puts some transparency and puts some systems in place that we can all follow. And I'll give you an example. A candidate or a head of a political group, let's say it's Bemidji or Cottage Grove or Glencoe, Minnesota, receives notice from the board of a complaint. Currently, there is nowhere online or in publication where a person can refer to the procedures for how the board might undertake its investigation or what rights a person has that's subject to an investigation. This problem raises not only due process issues, but simply fairness and efficiency problems. Therefore, we're saying in here the board needs to create an outline of its investigative procedures and make those procedures available to everyone. And I heard a couple of senators in here talk about making sure that it's public. The Board on Judicial Standards has the investigative procedures that can be used as a model. It's already in place. Let's use it. In keeping with the governor's on session, this provision specifically requires that the board issue rules where summary proceedings may be available. The use of summary proceedings, such as the determination by the board as to how the law is applied, is undisputed. Facts in the specific case can be an efficient way to resolve complaints, save taxpayer dollars, and reduce burdens on private parties. And then I just want to point out in this section, it should not be difficult for the board to issue these rules, because here's the membership of the board. Members of the board include a former chief administrative law judge for Minnesota, a former trial court judge who sat on the bench for 30 years, three former legislators, and an election lawyer. That wealth of talent should have no problem creating simple investigative procedures using example rules already in place in other Minnesota agencies. Amendment to Subdivision 11A, setting forth that the board makes that initial prima facie, or in the sense of it's the first look. And that's a requirement for that first look determination follows a complaint that mirrors the standard already in place for proceedings before administrative law judges under the Fair Campaign Practices Act. Currently, the board is compelled to investigate every complaint that is determined by staff. Yes? I'm sorry.
Excuse me.
Senator Hayden.
Madam Chair, I think Senator Hoffman, you're doing a fantastic job. I just didn't know if you were going over the same things that the Senate Council had gone over. If you have extra or more, I'd love to hear it. If not, I think it just appeared to be that you were going down the same road that she went, and I know that we're all a little pressed for time in this room, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, I guess the redundancy piece is there. I just wanted to clarify just on the face top of it that we can go in depth, but I'm fine. I mean,
and
there's
Senator
only two more
Hoffman,
points.
It's my understanding that this is an amendment that you've worked on. It's not part of the board's recommendations. Perhaps we should give the board a chance to respond to the amendment if they would like to.
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Mr. Goldsmith.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Gary Goldsmith. I'm the Executive Director of the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. I've had just a brief few moments to review this amendment, as I hadn't seen it before it was handed out today. Looking at it, I don't see anything that seems to be a problem. I think Senator Hoffman is doing a service both to the board and the community by pointing out some inadequacies in our procedures. There are some very sparse rules regarding conducting investigations, but they aren't sufficient to lay out a process, and I do agree that a process ought to be laid out and that rulemaking is the appropriate way to do that. So I know this bill is moving to another committee, actually to the whole Rules and Administration Committee, and I'll take the time to look at this amendment and talk to Senator Hoffman about it. If I see any real problems, I'll certainly communicate with him and work with him on resolving them.
Thank you very much, Mr. Goldsmith. On the A1 amendment, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Senator Hoffman, on your amended version of the bill, Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify either in support or in opposition to Senate File 2402? Seeing none, Senator Hoffman, thank you. Senator Hoffman moves that Senate File 2402 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Rules Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
The motion is adopted, motion is agreed to and passed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman, and members. We have run out of time to hear Senate File 1778, and we will do our best to